table that someone's serving a long prison term for a violent offense, maybe that term needs to be cut.
And with that, we're going to have to wrap up. Jason, thank you so much for being with us this morning. I'm Doug McVeigh, your guest host. Wednesday Talk Radio, our regular host, Paul Rowland, is out at the moment. Jason Zeidenberg, our guest, Director of Policy and Research for the Justice Policy Institute. Again, Jason, thank you so much, and have a great morning, everybody.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you to your listeners.
I hang my head and cry.
Dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KABU is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Attention, KABU members. You are invited to give your feedback on KABU's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KABU board and staff members created draft mission and vision statements. Now we want to know what you think. This is your chance to help define KABU's guiding principles and priorities. Visit KABU.fm to review the draft mission and vision statements and submit your comments. Paper copies of the draft statements are also available at the station. Comments are due July 17th. If you have questions, please contact Monica Beamer at monica@kabu.org. Thank you for contributing to the development of KABU's mission and vision statements and for your support of Community Radio.
And this is Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Here's what we got coming up for you this morning. Coming up on Political Perspectives, next, host Jennifer Kemp interviews Joel Weistheimer about his book, What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. At 9:30, we'll hear an interview with Guardian environmental reporter Suzanne Goldenberg about the significance of an email which shows that Exxon has been aware of the link between its operations and climate change for quite some time. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, journalist and filmmaker John Pilger on the last-minute flip-flop and betrayal of the Greek people by their own government. And at 11 on The Food Show, Karen Lazarus talks about her new cookbook, Sweet Mary Jane, 75 delicious cannabis-infused high-end desserts. Historian Richard Engeman talks about collecting organ food ephemera, also OMSI's Season of Food Science and the up-and-coming Montevilla Food Co-op. Thanks, members of KABU, for your generous support for Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can easily become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking right where it says Donate Today. Thanks in advance for doing that. We would be happy to have you join us. And now we'll get to Political Perspectives, host Jennifer Kemp with Joel Weistheimer.
They This is Jennifer Kemp on Political Perspectives. Today's public schools are being more and more dominated by standardized tests. Art, drama, and civics education classes are being thrown by the wayside, and teachers are given less and less leeway to be creative in what they teach. In this educational climate, what kind of citizens are schools creating? Do they value social justice and an equitable society? Do they have the knowledge and the skills to participate in local government and in their communities? Are they law-abiding people who vote in elections and donate to food drives? Or are schools turning out students who know how to take a test but don't even know what it means to be an active citizen in a democracy? Today, my guest, author and educator Joel Westheimer, explores these questions and more as we discuss his latest book, What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. So what flaws do you see in education today, and what do you see as the root causes of these issues?
For the last 10 or 15 years, what we've seen in education reform is a narrowing of the curriculum to only those two subjects, math and literacy, that are being focused on for standardized tests. And so in that process, we're seeing other aspects of the curriculum, even other subjects like science and social studies and history, and then not to mention, of course, drama and the arts and citizenship skills. All of those are being pushed to the back burner or taken off the stove altogether to make room for endless preparation for months and months for these standardized tests. And then even within those two subject areas, math and literacy, the kinds of skills and capacities that are being taught and measured by those standardized tests are even only a small portion of those subjects. And the other thing that this situation brings about is a kind of deprofessionalizing of teaching, where teachers are treated like interchangeable parts, and they're feeling like their hands are tied when it comes to drawing on their own interests and passions in developing the most enriching learning environments possible.
You see where education is going today as negatively impacting both students and teachers?
Yeah, well, and those are almost the same thing. But people fail to realize that teachers' workplace conditions are, of course, students' learning conditions. We're talking about the same place, the classroom. So when we have too many kids stuffed into a classroom or a boring curriculum or teachers prevented from drawing on their own passions and interests to develop interesting lesson plans, then we're talking about not just affecting teachers' workplace, but, of course, students' learning. Now, there are plenty of teachers, of course, across, you know, the Oregon, across the country, who are doing amazing things in their classrooms, and there's some wonderful programs out there. And I write about many of those programs in my book that just came out, What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. But the thing is that the teachers are doing that kind of work despite what education reform is offering them rather than because of it or with the assistance of education reform.
I see. Describe your own experience working in education. How have they shaped your perspectives on what school should be like?
Well, I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade in the New York City public schools. What happens when we're a new teacher is we come into the school and we kind of have an image in our mind of kind of writing a new script for everything that's going on there. We're going to be different than all the teachers we had, and the kids are going to like us and do work for us because they like us and respect us. And we think that we're going to get to write this new script and then start the play in motion. What new teachers don't realize is that the play has already started, and we're probably coming in Act 3 or Act 4. So there's already a kind of narrative that is in place before the new teacher gets anywhere near the school. I'll give you an example of this. Ask kids what happens when a substitute teacher comes to the room. And they say, of course, you know, oh, chaos. You know, everything is just madness. We change our names. We move the desks around. We tell the substitute teacher that their regular teacher lets them eat lunch at 9:15 and gives them a break at 9:20. You know, it's madness, right? I mean, Socrates himself could arrive in the classroom as a substitute teacher, and it would still be madness. Although we don't control the whole script, we can change change the narrative. And I tell a story about my experiences with a student named Arkeem. Arkeem was a kind of thorn in my side sort of student. He was both my most difficult student and also secretly one of my favorites because he had a kind of sparkle in him that gave him a sense of, he was a very smart kid who had learned that he just wasn't very good at school. And through my experiences with Arkeem, it did help shape a lot of how I think about teaching and learning today.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up Arkeem. You actually anticipated my next question. So talk about your experience with Arkeem, which you did a little bit. What was Arkeem's epiphany, and how can his example be used to show how teachers can best relate to their students?
What had happened in, I was teaching a social studies class, and it met before lunch, and Arkeem was one of the students in that class. And we had spent weeks talking about slavery and the civil rights movement and other aspects of American history, particularly with respect to African-American students. Arkeem was an African-American student, as were several other students in the class. And I noticed that the kids were very good at talking about this stuff. You know, they of course, thought slavery was terrible, and they thought that racism is terrible. And we, you know, when we talked about World War II, they thought that Hitler was a bad man. You know, all of the things that we all know are widely agreed cultural assumptions about good and bad. But they would leave my classroom after these discussions about civil rights, and I noticed that as they ran out towards the schoolyard, they would be calling each other faggot or spick or other derogatory terms. And it made me start to wonder whether there was carryover from these pat lessons of historical significance, whether they would be able to take that into thinking critically about the world around them today. What other forms of oppression are there today? So I had an idea. It was Gay Pride Week. And now this was in the 1980s, so this was, fairly margin-pushing stuff. But for Gay Pride Week, this teacher had put up a display in one of those glass cabinets in the hallway with the principal's permission. And a couple of days after he put it up with documenting things about Gay Pride Week, someone or a group of students, we don't know, had smashed the glass of the display case in. And so there it was, shattered. And the principal and the teacher decided that they were just going to leave it like that for some time. And I thought that was an interesting idea. And I had this idea. I decided to talk to the janitor who I had become friendly with. And I asked him to come in to my classroom the next time this social studies class was meeting and bring his most noisy power tool and come in and tell me that he had to fix something right then and just start making a lot of noise. And he was a bit of a ham, like I am, and he decided, yeah, he would do that. So the next day we're again continuing our discussion on civil rights, and he comes in, he sets up a step ladder, climbs up to the light, and starts hammering away. And I say, what are you doing? And he said, well, I got to fix this light. I said, but I'm having class now. Do you have to fix it right now? And he said, oh, yeah, got to be now. I said to the students, look, we can't have class here. Grab your chairs, and we're going to go out into the hall and sit in a circle there. And I got them all, and we sat in this big semicircle right in front of this display case where the glass had been smashed in. And then I continued to the discussion, and I waited to see what would happen. And I waited, and Arkeem at some point raised his hand. And I said, yes, Arkeem. And he said, well, it's like that. And he pointed to the display case. And I said, like what, Arkeem? And he said, well, it's judging people just when you don't really know anything about them, just by some kind of category they're in, just like that smashed glass. And I tried not to look too surprised. and we started a discussion on what it means, what's the link between homophobia and racism, and what do these forms of oppression have in common, and what could we do about them? What was done then? What could be done now? And the discussion went right through the end of the period, and now other students were coming out of their classes, and they gathered around because they saw us in the hallway in front of this display case, and lots of students had lots of things to say. Now, it wasn't a progressive teacher's nirvana or anything. Lots of students said all kinds of still homophobic or insulting things. But what was interesting is that it did get the students talking about current forms of oppression and thinking critically about the debates on homophobia and homosexuality and gay rights. And what's more important, things changed for our Keem from then on. He didn't become an A-plus student or anything, but he seemed to stand a little taller. And later on, students would quote our Keem, you know, in a discussion. They would say, well, like, it was what our Keem said last week. And you could see our Keem kind of taking that in. And he eventually told me he wanted to be a community organizer. And we stayed in touch for some time after that. And it taught me the power of the possibility of changing the narrative of schooling.
Yeah, that's a great story, and I think draws really important connections between different types of oppression that maybe students might not immediately see. So in the book, you lay out three different definitions of a good citizen. What are the three definitions, and how do they differ from each other?
I'm glad you asked about that, because that really does, in some sense, the book is about what the purpose of schooling is. But at the heart of the book is some extensive research that my colleague Joe Kahn from Mills College in Oakland, California, and I conducted over a number of years about programs in schools that say that they're teaching good citizenship. And, you know, if you and I went out and asked 100 people whether they think schools should teach good citizenship, and most people would probably say, yeah, of course, sure. But when you ask more detailed question, you scratch below the surface a little and ask, what do you mean by good citizenship? What exactly should schools teach about that? That's where you start to get a lot of disagreement, right? So we became interested in this question, what kind of citizen are schools asking students to become? Because all schools teach citizenship skills of some kind or another, just the act of waiting in line or following the rules or waiting till other people speak before you speak and so forth. And so the reason the book is called What Kind of Citizen is because we were interested in the different visions of a good citizen that different school programs put forward. And so we came up when we looked at quite a number of programs across the United States, and then we expanded. I did work in Canada. We've even done some work internationally. And we found that most schools have the visions of citizenship that could be described by these three names. And we called them the personally responsible citizen, the participatory, as in participation, citizen, and the social justice-oriented citizen. The personally responsible citizen, these are programs that have a vision of good citizenship that's about following the rules, you know, showing up to work on time or school, paying your taxes, being a nice person, not littering, helping an old person across the street, or giving blood during a blood drive. Those are by far the most common programs in schools, ones that teach a personally responsible vision of a good citizen. Less common, but still around, are programs that have a participatory vision of citizenship. And these are programs that emphasize knowing how government works or how community organizations work, how you can get involved and participate in your community. So, like, one of the things I like to say is if the participatory citizens are organizing a food drive, then the personally responsible citizens are donating a can of food. Now, a third vision of a good citizen that is probably the least represented in schools is the social justice-oriented citizen. And these are programs that have a particular emphasis on asking kids to think about the root causes of problems. They might teach about social movements and how they work. They might ask students to think critically about different policy approaches to solving problems like economic inequality or environmental issues, or crime, homelessness, and so forth. Or we could say if the participatory citizens are organizing a food drive and the personally responsible citizens are donating a can of food, then the social justice-oriented citizens are asking, how come in one of the richest countries in the world we have people who are hungry? Right? They're looking at for the root cause of why something happens and what we can do about, how we can improve society.
So as a result of the standardized testing, do you think that some of the types of citizenships are more favored than the other types? Like, do some mesh better with this new kind of standardization in schools?
Well, two things are going on simultaneously. One is that talk about citizenship education and even social studies and even history has simply been eliminated altogether in some areas. On the other hand, there is, I think, an unfortunate confluence of the types of citizenship skills and attitudes that are embedded in the personally responsible citizen with the kind of behaviors that too many school reformers want for these standardized tests. The standardized testing movement does promote a certain kind of citizenship, and it's what we might call a docile kind of citizen. In a democratic society, we need something different, right? We need people who are able to participate in governing themselves, in making the rules for their own society, and helping to solve problems. And therefore, schools, as the only institution we have where all our citizens attend, or almost all, have a heavy responsibility to teach those skills of democratic citizenship. And if you remember the three types of citizens, the personally responsible citizen, there's not a country in the world that wouldn't be happy to have citizens who are personally responsible, right? Every country wants citizens to pay taxes and to obey the law and to be nice and to help people when help is needed and not to litter. But so those are good citizenship skills, but they have nothing to do with democracy. The things that have to do with democracy are learning to participate and to debate important issues of social concern and help to set policy to move forward.
What type of people do you think would advocate for each conception of citizenship? And do you think that this correlates with where they are on the political spectrum?
I do think that people who want schools to teach only obedience and loyalty without any form of questioning or deep thinking probably are people who value a sense of order. The thing is that those people probably would value less the idea that the way democracy in our society works is through embracing not only compliance, like not only following the rules, but also dissent, because dissent is the engine of progress in a democratic society.
Talk about the Madison County Youth Service League and the Bayside Students for Justice. What were the goals of the programs, and what values and skills did the students learn in each program?
Yeah, so after we did this, the part of the research on defining these three visions of citizenship, we then featured a couple of programs and looked very, very carefully at those. And both of these, it's important to say, were excellent programs that the kids got a lot out of, but they got different sets of skills. So the Madison County Youth Service League kids did a lot. They organized curbside trash pickup for their community, and they got editorials in the newspaper and so forth, and they did a lot of getting things done work where they really accomplished a lot in their community, and they reported the thrill of that their learning was so real, that they worked in the community doing service learning projects and tied it to their curriculum and were able to accomplish more than they thought they would have. And so that was very positive for them. The Bayside Students for Justice also did community work, but were very focused on what I described before as the social justice-oriented citizen. They were asking hard questions about why things are the way they are and how might we change society so that things are more fair. So not just alleviating the symptoms of something, but looking at the root causes of the problem. And what we found at the end of the program is that kids in the Bayside Students for Justice program had a sense of power and politics. They understood why there was opposition to certain things, who would oppose certain policies, why it's difficult to get to the root causes of problems, and how you might be able to look at root causes of problems and be successful. Whereas the Madison County Youth Service League students had much less of an interest in those deeper political issues and those deeper root causes issues. On the other hand, the Bayside Students for Justice kids came out a bit discouraged because they had more trouble getting things done for the higher bar that they had set themselves, whereas the Madison County Youth Service League kids really accomplished quite a lot in terms of organizing recycling or cleaning up a park and those kinds of things. And so our point was not that one program is better than the other, but that different programs achieve different goals, and that it's important to pay attention to those goals when we think about the purpose of schooling in a democratic society. And so the book which again is called What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. In the end, I detail a whole bunch of programs across the United States that try and take on these goals in different ways. And they're unique programs with wonderful, passionate teachers at the helm. And they really are a wonderful example of what is possible in our nation's schools.
So can these skill sets be taught effectively to all age groups? Are very young children capable of grasping the critical thinking skills needed to be a participatory citizen, or do you think these skills should be taught later on?
Well, I love that question because, you know, on the one hand, people might say, you know, well, we can't, like, teach, you know, kindergartners about the Armenian genocide or something like that. And of course, we need age-appropriate curriculum. On the other hand, the idea that we're not going to teach issues of social justice or of fairness to kids always strikes me, to young kids, always strikes me as kind of funny because anyone who's a parent knows one of the mantras of childhood, right? I certainly had it with my children. Kids love saying, it's not fair. And we hear that over and over again. And so in some ways, it's the youngest kids who have the keenest sense or the most sensitivity to these issues of fairness or justice. And it's really the adults who've kind of been desensitized to that. When I used to walk with my kids in downtown Manhattan and we would pass homeless people, it was my kids who asked all kinds of tough questions about that. How come this person doesn't have a home? How come they don't have a job? How come they don't have enough to eat? Why are they living on the street? What's it like living on the street? So it's really the youngest kids who have an opportunity to engage issues of fairness and justice in really deep and meaningful ways.
So these next couple of questions are kind of moving back in the direction of systemic issues with education. So early in the book, you mentioned the civic opportunity gap. What is that? And how does access to civics education vary by class?
Yeah, well, this is again, building on research by my colleague. Joe Kahn and his colleagues have found is that to the extent that civic education is taught in schools, it's taught differently to children from poorer or wealthier backgrounds. And it's taught differently in the following ways. Kids from poorer backgrounds or in poorer neighborhoods tend to get a kind of citizenship education that emphasizes following the rules or knowing bits and facts of information, like, you know, how a bill becomes a law or how old you have to be president. Whereas kids from wealthier backgrounds tend to be in schools where the citizenship education has a different focus. They teaches some facts and information, but it also emphasizes the idea of participation and critical thinking. And it's that kind of critical thinking experiences, and in particular experiences in the community that are tied to the curriculum, that we know from research offer the richest and most successful forms of civic education.
And then how do you think that the civic opportunity gap, say, affects kids as they grow up or when they are adult?
That's a good question. We have a lot of good information about that because we know that kids who are exposed to better forms of civic education early on, in particular forms where they've had experiences in the community, doing work with the community and being engaged themselves, those kids are much more likely to vote, to be involved in their communities, and to engage civically, which also means that they're much more likely to argue for their own interests in the community and therefore be able to improve their lives. Whereas students who do not have those experiences in school or who have bad civic education can be negatively impacted in a number of ways, not the least of which is that they fail to engage in community participation. They don't vote. They don't get involved in ways that could possibly help them, and they don't. They're therefore unable or less able to fight for their own interests and the interests of improving society.
So this is my final question, but how do you think that schools can best prepare students to be good citizens? What skills and values need to be taught?
Well, ironically, the kinds of things that schools could do to prepare students to be the best kinds of citizens for a democratic society are also the kinds of teaching and learning that benefit learning the basics, like math and literacy and science and social studies and so forth, because they're the most engaging. Many years ago, a lot of educators, including the famous education philosopher John Dewey, wanted to focus the school curriculum around the social studies so that we could tie the other subject areas into the service of what's most important, which is our social world, right? Our human world that we live in. And so they would take a social problem like homelessness or violence or poverty, and they would put that at the center of the curriculum, and then the skills from all the subject areas would lend themselves to learning the skills needed to address that problem of concern. And I'd like to see a little more of that be brought back so that students learn, we would never hear again, you know, why do I need to know this, or what's this for? That students would learn that the things they're learning in school have meaning for the world outside of school and for their place in that world. We need to teach kids that democracy is not a spectator sport. It's something that you have a say in, that you have a role in shaping history. And I think we need to bring schools back to that traditional public purpose of public education. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that if the citizenry is not well educated enough to govern their own affairs, then the solution is not to take that power of governance away from them, but rather to educate them. And that's really where the founding of our public schools came from, was the idea that you needed an educated population in order to have a well-functioning democracy.
Well, those are about all the questions that I have. I don't know if there's anything else that you'd like to add, or if you think we kind of covered most of it.
I think it's pretty good.
Great. Well, yeah, thanks again for speaking with me today, Joel. This is really helpful, and I really enjoyed your book.
Great. Well, I'm really glad to talk to you about it. It was a lot of fun.
Again, this was Joel Westheimer, author of What Kind of Citizen on Political Perspectives. Richard Tolman.